I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetsky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks, a food company that produces sweet and savory bars with whole nuts, spices, and fruit, among other products. Kind is sold in a diversity of locations, including Whole Foods, Costco, Amtrak trains, and newspaper stands. Daniel is also the founder of Peaceworks, a producer of Mediterranean spreads such as tapenades, hummus, and baba ganoush. Peaceworks aims to foster business relationships among neighbors in the Middle East and other groups in conflict as a way to reduce conflict in those regions. Daniel grew up in Mexico City and speaks Spanish, English, Hebrew, and French, and a little bit of Yiddish, no? Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jessica.
Before we dig into Kind, I want to talk about Peaceworks, which was the company you founded in 1993 that focuses on Mediterranean spreads. What was the germ for founding this food company in the early 90s?
I didn't know it was going to be a food company. It was more about trying to use business as a force for bringing Arabs and Israelis together. That was what I was very passionate about since writing my college thesis and law school work about how to use market forces to help trading partners shatter cultural stereotypes, cement relations with each other. So that was the impetus of what I was doing. And it became a food company because as I was looking for ventures, I was looking in apparel, I was looking in Dead Sea minerals, and food became the area where I found my passions best. I didn't understand Dead Sea minerals too well, but I understood food, and that's how it started.
And so food was secondary to the primary mission was to facilitate joint ventures among conflicting neighbors. So what's an example of a collaboration which you established at Peaceworks between two conflicting groups?
Well, the flagship venture, which still exists today, which is how we started, was my discovery of a sun-dried tomato spread. And when I, long story short, found out the company had gone bankrupt because it was sourcing its glass jars from Portugal and its sun-dried tomatoes from Italy, and it was very expensive. And when I came to Yoel Benesh, the Israeli manufacturer, and told him about my ideas, he had Arab friends, and he really believed in the philosophy of what we're trying to do with Peaceworks. But I also showed him that he could benefit economically, that he could buy the glass jars from Egypt instead of Portugal, the sun-dried tomatoes from Turkish suppliers instead of Italian ones. So they started buying basil and olives and olive oil from Palestinian citizens of the West Bank and Gaza, and that's how it started.
How did you secure distribution in the United States with Peaceworks? Can you walk through that process? Because in a way, you piggybacked on that with Kind.
Well, I didn't know what I was doing, so I emptied my legal briefcase. Literally, I had this big briefcase for carrying legal documents, and I filled it up with jars of sun-dried tomato spreads, basil pestos, olive spreads. And I would start at the top of Broadway on 122nd Street on the west side, and then just start walking store by store till I would go at 7 a.m. in the morning until I would end at 7 p.m. at night in the bottom of Wall Street, and then I would cross the next day and I would go up Broadway on the other side of Broadway. And Broadway was an important choice because it was the avenue that I found to have the most concentration of grocery stores. So I knew Second Avenue, I knew Third Avenue, I knew Madison, I did all of them, but Broadway was the juiciest. And I would not go to the next store unless I got either an order or an explanation for what I needed to do different in order to get an order the next time. And I drove many people nuts because everything was wrong, but they were basically taught me, like Scott Goldshine and Mr. Zabar from Zabar's basically taught me what the consumers were looking for. So I really learned a lot of what I do today from all the store managers and buyers at the grocery shops and bodegas in New York City.
What is an example of something that Mr. Zabar, you know, taught you?
everything. I mean, I came in and they didn't have much patience because they had thousands of consumers going around and here I am and I don't know what I'm doing. But they really liked that they really cared about my mission. And I think they just had patience with me. So they taught me what is the margin requirements for a retailer, for a distributor, and for yourself so that you can run an ongoing business. They taught me about the labels, how to make sure that the name is clearer. the jars back then were oozing olive oil out of them, and that was not acceptable. So it was a lot of sessions.
You mentioned that you had a law degree. You went to Stanford Law School and you became a lawyer. And the idea for PeaceWorks came out of a paper, your thesis that you wrote, which I believe was entitled Incentives for Peace and Profits, Federal Legislation to Encourage U.S. Enterprises to Invest in Arab-Israeli Joint Ventures.
Yeah, it became a very famous document among doctors, because if you were having insomnia and were having trouble falling asleep, they would give it to you. You would read it and you would fall asleep immediately, because it was the most theoretical, boring thing in the world. It was totally devoid of practical use, but it was beautiful theoretically.
You dabbled in the law before starting businesses. You had a stint at Sullivan and Cromwell. You clerked for Supreme Justice in Texas. Did you think that you might want a career in law?
I loved the law. It was not that I was trying to escape the law. I just had this, you call it a germ, I had this bug inside me that I just really felt that my mission in life was to try to build bridges and to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. And suddenly here's the Oslo peace process. So all my ideas that I've been sharing for several years, suddenly they go from being delusional to being slightly tenable. And I'm like, all right, I have to try to pursue it and I have to try it.
You also had a kind of a social ethos in your family. Your father was a prominent figure in your upbringing and the way you think about the world. He was a Holocaust survivor, having survived Dachau, the concentration camp in Germany. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Yeah, my dad was my greatest hero and role model. He was the most humble person. He built himself from scratch. He came to Mexico after the war. He was 15 and a half years old when the war started, 16 when he got to Mexico. He didn't speak Spanish or English.
He's from Lithuania originally.
Yeah, he was born in Riga, Latvia, and raised in Lithuania when he was 9 years old, 1939. The war started, and I'll tell you the story, it's a little strong, but he was coming back with his father to the apartment house where they lived, and the superintendent showed them into where the garage was, and he opened the door of the garage and there was a pile of bodies, and he told my grandfather, you see all these people, they're all the Jews in the building, and you're lucky that you always were nice to me and treated me with respect and kindness, so I spared you and your family, but get out before I change my mind. So that night, my father, who was 9 years old, and his brother and my grandfather and grandmother packed whatever they could carry, and then they left into a ghetto. And that was a story that my dad told me when I was 9 years old, and my mom said, Roman, what are you doing? This kid is 9 years old, you know. You're going to, what are you doing? Please stop telling him this. And my dad said, look, he's 9 years old and he needs to hear it. Mm-hmm. I was 9 years old and I needed to live it. But the other thing that was no less powerful and important was the stories that he told me about people that in the worst of circumstances would rise up and do something kind, like this German soldier that threw a potato to him. And my dad used to tell the story of how he felt he was going to die and he was really malnourished, and that potato meant for him the difference and survival, and the soldier took a risk by giving him food for the soldiers. So those were the stories that I most admire, the way my dad always remembered the moments of kindness. I mean, it's the darkest of moments. And there's a quote that I really love that connects to that, about from Rabbi Hillel, that says, in a place where there is no humanity, strive thou to be human.
So the name Kind Healthy Snacks, did your father have influence on the naming of the product?
The name Kind was created by my team, and I, it's really fascinating that we finally zoned in on it, because it wasn't, today it's so obvious that that's perfect name for us, but back then we had all these crazy ideas for the name. The reason we came up with Kind is that it had human attributes that we were really trying to aspire to be a part, to define us, you know, to do the kind thing for your body, to do the kind thing for your taste buds and to do the kind thing for your world.
It's striking that your father was very forthcoming with his stories and chose to talk about the wartime versus others who really receded and did not tell their family such stories, just more for self-preservation and family's preservation than anything. What was the impetus for your family's, your father's moving to Mexico, of all places,
Jessica, can I just comment on the thing you just said, because it's really important. I was surrounded by other Holocaust survivors growing up, and I loved them dearly, but you could tell that they were just consumed by the horrible horrors that they had gone through, and they couldn't have a positive outlook. And my dad, or there were others that were able to just shut it out and just have a positive life moving forward. My dad had the strength to recall those horrors, but in a positive way. And still, he was such a sweet, kind-hearted man, very gregarious, always making people laugh, always almost like he saw his mission to make people have a better day and make people laugh. Did you see the movie Life is Beautiful? So when I saw that movie, I cried a lot, and then I was a little bit troubled because I felt guilty to be laughing also. And I asked my dad, you know, it never crossed my mind that in such horrible circumstances you could actually say jokes in the middle of a concentration camp. And my dad said the opposite. The only reason my dad felt that he survived is because my grandfather was a really funny joke teller, and he would entertain the Jewish inmates and the German soldiers with funny stories and make people more humane and more human by making them laugh and just find, particularly in those more dark moments, some levity.
You were brought up in Mexico City. How was being Jewish in a predominantly Christian place?
Well, I also lived in a very insulated cocoon. You pointed out earlier, I learned Yiddish at an early age, and I learned Yiddish before I learned Hebrew or English. And for my mom, it was very important that I build bridges. So she introduced me to this kid named Luis, who we made play dates in our neighborhood for me to be friends with him. And I was in such a cocoon that, you know, we were playing once, and I said, you know, if you do this, I'm going to kick you in the tuches. And he says, what? What is this tuches thing? And I'm like, stop joking. Tuches, tushin, you're back, you're behind, your ass. And he's like, no, that's nalga. I didn't know that tuches was a word in Yiddish. There were many other words that I can't tell you right now because they're stronger that I thought were Spanish, but were actually Yiddish. Mm-hmm. That's the world that I was raised in. And I think my mom was the one that gave us the impetus to make sure that we always built relationships with people that were different from us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetzky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks. We'll hear more from Daniel coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetzky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks, a food company that produces sweet and savory bars with a variety of whole nuts, spices, and fruit, among other products like granola. Daniel launched Kind in 2003, and its products can be found in several diverse locations, ranging from Whole Foods to convenience stores and gas stations. So here you are. You founded Peaceworks. You were running this Mediterranean food spread company. And what was the germ then for Kind Bars?
I was traveling all over, and I was very frustrated with my lack of healthy snacking options. It felt that if it was healthful and wholesome, it would not travel well. And what would travel well was either too indulgent or tasted like cardboard or was just totally artificial. I didn't find something that fit with what I was looking for. So my impetus was I was always on the lookout for healthy snacks, and Kind was the recognition that there were not those options.
What did you grab before you concocted the Kind bars? What are some of the things?
I truly, sincerely did not have very good options. I would take sometimes just nuts and fruit, but then the nuts, you overate them because you couldn't do portion control.
Which nuts?
Almonds, primarily, raw almonds. Yeah, of course, I also ate muffins, and I also still today eat, you know, some indulgent snacks here and there. I'm not perfect, but more and more, I think every day for me it's a journey to try to improve my lifestyle. I eat two kind bars every single day, no less than two. Today I've had three so far.
How many varieties, as of now, are there of kind bars?
I think we have like 25 flavors of kind bars.
Do you worry at all about the burden of choice? I enjoy your bars, but I'm a little overwhelmed when I'm like, oh, I don't know, just give me four choices.
I agree. It's a very, very tough challenge. Did you read the book Paradox of Choice?
No, but I understand the phenomenon. That's how I feel.
Sometimes you feel paralyzed by those choices. So I think we do need to, we look at this constantly, and it is a balance, because when we discontinue products, the first person to pick up the phone is my brother. It's like, why do you always discontinue the ones that are my favorites? Because you always find someone that was the biggest fan of that walnut date or the sesame chocolate, and they were among our lowest turning items, but they had a core following of fans. And so that's the tricky, and each of them is like your children, you love them all, so you don't want to like give the death to anyone, but you have to be disciplined.
So returning to the early days of Kind, here you are like Willy Loman selling your your piece works. That's from Death of a Salesman, by the way.
I know.
Selling your piece works.
I know Willy Loman too well. I can tell you my Willy Loman moment.
Please.
I'm in Waldbaum's, which is a grocery chain at their headquarters, and I look around. It's all vinyl furniture from the 1960s. Everybody surrounding me is like 50 years older than me, and they all have sampling suitcases like mine. And I'm like, wow, what am I doing with my life? And this was a very tough moment right before the launch of Kind. Little did I know that after 10 years of killing myself, success was just around the corner. Oh my God, we've been trying so hard and it just hasn't worked out. And
with this Mediterranean spread company.
Yeah, with the Meditale spreads, they were great products, but there was a very small niche and there was 1,000 things that I had done wrong. And I'm just like, wow, you know, I threw away my law career. My dad is worried. My mom is worried. And am I ever going to get married? Am I going to have children? but I really, you know, we were having such difficult time making ends meet, just being able to make payroll. And just, I had to take a $24,000 salary for many years. And many months, I could not even pay myself my monthly portion. And then, you know, a couple years later, suddenly Kind, we finally hit it with Kind, and then it just explodes. It just shows you that when you believe in something, you should be careful not to give up, because it can be just around the corner.
In that dark place, little did you know that the success of Kind was almost in your grasp. You continued to go door-to-door, still after over a decade of this Peaceworks company. You were fortunate, though, because you had this distribution network in place, albeit small, that the Mediterranean spreads was the Trojan horse for your Kind bars.
We were fortunate, above all, that people liked us. That people thought, these guys deserve a break. And I think there was a lot of goodwill in there. If you had asked me the year when we launched Kind, whether I knew that it was going to succeed and be explosive, of course I believed in it, otherwise I wouldn't be doing it. But I, to be sincere, and I consider myself a person that has a good vision and can dream, I could have never imagined that Kind would become what it became.
One of the innovations of Kind was that they were, you know, actual nuts and fruit, and that they weren't pasty. Why are so many bars historically that are sold in retail kind of that, you know, that pasty consistency?
Well, it's easier to run a product through the line if it's a paste or an emulsion. It's called a slab bar in our space because it goes slabs of product that fall in the sheeter, and they are all homogeneous and they all run through the line very efficiently. So it's a very efficient way to run a lot of product very fast. And when we came up with the temerity to try to think of it differently, a lot of times the manufacturers that we approached said, you know, it's not practical for us because your runs are very low and it's so much less efficient to run your product. It was hard to convince not just the manufacturers, but even the retailers. We would go with our products and show them our whole nut and fruit bars, and they'd say, yeah, where do I put your product? I'm like, well, next to all these other nutritional bars. I'm like, no, that's not a nutritional bar. Let me show you what a nutritional bar looks like. And they'd show us the slab bars, and it was very hard to convince them to give us a shot in those sets.
You were selling a product that you would say that you could, whose ingredients you could see and pronounce. And why was the clear package, such an innovation? Why were there opaque packages before? I mean, it seems like common sense, but you know, what's the big deal?
The most obvious things may not seem obvious before they're done, right? So when we were doing it, the conventional wisdom was that you had to use opaque film to prevent the product from oxidizing, from losing moisture, and that you needed to use aluminum foil or other opaque materials. We worked really hard in creating clear wrappers with the technology that it could have all those properties through clear film. It's actually deceptively simple, but it was very hard to achieve that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetzky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks, a food company that produces bars with whole nuts and fruit, among other products. I want to talk about nuts for a moment. I'm partial to almonds. There are rankings of nuts that are more nutritional than others and more rare. And teach me something about nuts.
Depends on which industry association you talk to. They each are going to tell you that theirs are better. But certainly, I think the consensus is that almonds, walnuts are among the most helpful or a very helpful category. But everything that's nuts, pecans, pistachios, cashews also have some role. Cashews have more fat than almonds and walnuts. But what's more important to highlight is, did you read about the Harvard study? There was a study that came out by the Harvard School of Medicine that if you eat more nuts, you will live longer. It was like staggering. I actually used to, when I launched Kind and I knew it was a healthful product, I used to be very careful about not eating more than one Kind bar a day because I just felt that I don't want to eat too many fats. And the data indicates that what's powerful about nuts at a minimum is that they're highly satiating, and so they displace empty calories. And then on top of that, the nuts have the fats that are helpful to your heart, that help reduce your bad cholesterol levels. So I do think that fundamentally nuts are an important building block.
You mentioned almonds and walnuts. Are they more expensive?
Yeah, on average, I think almonds are increasing in price. We just had a very tough crop where our prices went way up. There's a huge problem right now with bees. Bees are dying, and almost like 70% of all of our human consumption is pollinated by bees. And bees are dying by hordes, and they have to transport them and pollinate different farms. And then the transportation and the mono-pollination may be contributing to this problem of bee collapse. It's a very serious, very scary problem.
Regarding distribution, was there an important relationship or kind of pivot that caused the floodgates to open on the distribution front?
It's all been very gradual. We did it the right way this time because before, when I was starting, I used to try to be everything everywhere as soon as you can. And you really need to be smart about your distribution and migration strategy. You need to first start with the product, the stores where you're most solid consumer and fans are going to be. So it's like the Whole Foods and natural and the specialty stores. And so that's where we started. And we still today focus enormous efforts and marketing with our core because that's where they have traffic and loyal consumers. And only then we start going into national grocery chains and then convenience stores and specialty and alternative markets. And then only recently in the last couple of years did we start going into mass accounts like Walmart and Target and clubs like Costco and Sam's. It was very steady and gradual.
You mentioned before that you paid yourself a $24,000 salary, and initially your marketing budget for the first few years was, you know, like $800 of your sampling budget. But your salary and the sampling budget took a turn in 2008 when you brought on private equity investors in VMG, and they're a fund that invests in consumer products. And Darius Bykoff, the founder of Vitamin Water, or Glasso, made that introduction.
Correct.
How do you know Darius?
So Darius was friends with Andy and Melissa Komaroff, who are my dear friends for many years. And I was entertaining another transaction, and I asked Darius for advice. And I said, do I need to do it this way, this way, this way, which I'm being told? And he said, no, you don't. You can do it whatever way you want. And let me actually introduce you to VMG, and we'll co-invest. What I had done right until then was come up with a concept, with a product, with a good culture in the company. What I had not done right is that after 15 years of being in the wilderness, I was so scared to take risks and to invest in letting more people try our product. That's why our sampling budget was $800, because I saw that as an expense to be caught rather than as an investment. And then we suddenly realized, wow, 9 out of 10 people that try a Kind Bar become part of your franchise. And so thanks to my partners, we built that phenomenal field marketing team to let people sample. And so from the first 2009, it was an $800,000 budget instead of $800 before. And then today, it's about $13 million that we go into just giving new Kind Bars to new consumers.
And then in spring 2014, you bought back VMG's stake for $220 million, mostly cash deal, which was basically 13 times their initial investment. Things have come a long way since that Walbaum's moment.
Yes, the team that we have today, in particular, is you, every morning I wake up and I feel so blessed and so grateful to be working with people that are better than I will ever be at what they do.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetzky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks, a food company that produces bars with whole nuts and spices and fruit, among other products like granolas. I want to go back to your family for a moment. You mentioned before that your father had this positive stance. Do you feel like that was a biological proclivity, that he was just innately that way? You mentioned your grandfather was the same way.
Well, that's a great question. I ask related questions all the time, but not particularly that question. It's a really great question. I don't know. I do think that, I have four children, and from the day they're born, you can tell that they have personalities, and it's fascinating and wonderful to see how they really are their own persons, and they're quite different. I have twins, and they are quite different from each other. But I also do think that nurture can guide a person and shape them. I think it's a combination of DNA and genes and the environment. But then again, how did my dad in such an environment manage to be such an extraordinarily sweet, warm, and loving person? Was it because by then, by the age of 9, he had already built it up?
Do you meditate or exercise to enhance
I take a
these?
lot of time to think. We are so barraged with inputs like inbox, email, voicemail, Twitter, messengers, this, that. And you carry your smartphone everywhere you go, and you're just constantly trying to keep up with the data and read more news. And our brains are craving those data points. So I consciously try to find times in the day, sometimes when you're on, but it might also just be when you're taking a shower. It might also be right before you go to bed. It might be when you just have half an hour to rest and you're about to grab that phone and you say, you know what? Let me just be with myself and let me talk to myself.
Do you talk to yourself out loud?
No. I don't think I talk to myself out loud.
Because in Judaism, the reason you pray out loud is not so that God could hear you only, it's so that you could also hear yourself.
That's beautiful. I'll start paying attention to that, but I think it's more just
Silent.
focusing, yeah.
You are a magician.
A magician, yeah.
Magicians are entertainers. Making magic requires practice and repetition. In what way has magic influenced your business?
I think magic is definitely a big part of my personality and who I am, both because it requires you to be innovative and creative, and because of what you brought forth about how you need to be disciplined and practice, practice, practice. I think it's fun. And it also connects me to my dad, because my dad used to teach me magic when I was a little kid. And then when I was in college and studying abroad in Europe, I paid my trips through Europe by doing magic shows in the streets of Paris and in Bulgaria, and just had a lot of adventures doing magic.
What's one of your favorites?
One of my favorite magic?
Yeah. Wait.
Changing the time on your watch. I love card tricks also.
Speaking of cards, you have a kind card in your wallet. What is the meaning of this kind
So
card?
this is our latest in our effort to try to find ways to creatively inspire kindness. The challenge in doing that is that kindness, by its very essence, the reason it works is that it's a pure act where there's no ulterior purposes. So how do you inspire kindness without destroying its authenticity. So we've been toying with it for 10 years, and our latest is these cards called Kind Awesome cards, where if we spot somebody that has done a kind act already, either to you or to a stranger, then you celebrate them and say, you know, that was really kind of you, and in appreciation for your kindness, we'd like to give you this card. And you go to the website, enter this code, and we send you a couple kind bars plus another Kind Awesome card that you can then give to somebody else to celebrate when you spot an act of kindness that they do.
What's one act of kindness you spotted on the street the other day which caused you to take out this card and give it to a stranger?
Somebody ceded their taxi to my wife and I. It was very, very nice. And I went into my wallet, and they're like, oh, no, that's not necessary. They thought I was going to give them money. And I'm like, no, this is what it is. And then they were really happy. Or somebody cedes their seat in the subway to somebody else, or just, you know, on the sixth line on the subway lately, I don't know, people can get really mean to each other. And it's become like this laboratory of like social behavior. I don't know if you ever saw the Batman movie with the Joker, where he's like creating these social experiments in Metropolis, and people are like, are they going to do the right thing or the wrong thing? In the sixth train, a lot of times people are not doing the right thing. They're being really jerkish to each other. The trains are really delayed, and it's kind of scary. So when somebody behaves really kindly in those environments, I give them one of those cards.
On the sixth train, the Lexington Avenue line in New York City, you mentioned your wife briefly. She's a doctor. What kind of doctor is she?
She's a transplant nephrologist.
Ah, kidney.
Yeah, you know it. When I first met her and she's at a nephrologist, I'm like, oh, is that people that deal with the dead bodies? Like, no, that's a necrologist. I'm not a nephrologist. It's kidney doctor. I'm like, okay, good to know.
And a mother of four.
And a mother of four and an incredible partner, the sweetest woman in the world. And she goes to the Bronx to help for her job as a transplant nephrologist. And she's on call this week.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Jessica, thank you so much for having those really interesting questions.
My guest has been Daniel Lubetzky.
Coming up, we'll meet Michael Brown, co-founder of CityYear. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Michael Brown, co-founder of CityYear, an organization focused on addressing the national dropout crisis, where 1 million American students drop out of high school every year. CityYear's almost 3,000 core members serve as tutors, mentors, and role models in America's most challenging public schools. Prior to starting CityYear in 1988, Michael clerked for then-judge, now-justice Stephen Breyer. Welcome.
Thanks, Jessica. It's great to be here.
Could you tell me the experience of a CityYear core member?
So a CityYear core member is on average around 22 years old, gets up probably at the crack of dawn, some cases 5:30 in the morning, often before the sun, and they head into the urban communities around the country, and they go into some of the highest need schools, and as a team, they stand outside of the schoolhouse steps, and they clap and cheer for every student as they walk into the building, giving them high fives. And then they go into the school and they serve all day as tutors, mentors, and role models, helping kids who are probably, many of them, destined not to graduate, to graduate, by helping them get back on track.
Now, I've read somewhere that there are about 13,500 high schools in the United States, and 12% of them yield 50% of the dropouts. Is CityYear focusing on those specific high schools in that 12%?
Exactly. Yes, this is a breakthrough study that Johns Hopkins University put together, and it did find that about 1 million students drop out in America. The study further found that you can identify who's likely to drop out by these early warning indicators, high absences, poor behaviors, or getting an F in math or English. So what we do is we go into the high schools that have the worst dropout records, as well as the elementary and middle schools that feed into them. Mm. So we're in these students' lives in a multi-year continuum of care from grades 3 through 9.
Can you provide a concrete example or two of the experience of one of the children being impacted?
Yeah, so this is a student who, even the teachers had said, no one's been able to get through to this student. She's incredibly disruptive. It turns out that the core member found out that this student's mother was being deported. Now, if you can imagine trying to come to school every single day and being said, these are your lessons. These are the things you're supposed to do. This is the way you're supposed to deport yourself, all these other things. But no one had yet learned what was really happening in her life. Their mother's being deported. And she had put up all these walls around her. Mm-hmm. But the core member has that time mm-hmm. and that capability to be there. And as the student pushes her away, she just keeps saying, I'm still here for you. Mm-hmm. And eventually what happens time and again is the student realizes you're not going to go away. You really are here for me. And she opened up to that student. And that student succeeded and blossomed.
City Year now looks a lot different from the City Year that you started in 1988. Can you describe what your initial intention was?
So initially, we decided we really wanted to show that national service could really help all nonprofit initiative. Whatever it is that you were doing in your nonprofit, you could do more of it if you had dedicated young people to help and join you. Mm-hmm. So we basically offered these idealistic young people to all the nonprofits in the community.
Ranging from
building community gardens, say in the morning, to helping senior citizens in the afternoon, to running after school programs, really the full range of nonprofit initiatives, doing the food banks. And then the exciting thing is that AmeriCorps got started, and there were many organizations that were now developing. We certainly no longer needed to be doing all different kinds of work. And we found that our unique asset of these idealistic young people could have its highest use if we put them into the highest need schools.
You have a powerful partnership network at City Year, ranging from Timberland to IBM and JetBlue. Timberland, for example, supplied all the boots for your initial core members and now continue to supply the shoes. It just seems like you've had a charmed life a little bit since inception with these partnerships. Is that the case?
So when we started City Year, we sat down on this new computer. It was called a Macintosh computer. We fancied ourselves as social entrepreneurs, and we were inspired by, you know, at the time, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak were starting a computer business out of their garage. And we said, what if we sat at my parents' dining room table in Belmont, Massachusetts, and hammered out this idea? And we had this document that said, please support this program called City Year. Would you give us our first grant? And we went around. We get meetings with companies and philanthropic leaders. And the interesting thing is, in the beginning, almost nobody said no, but nobody said yes. They would all ask, who's already supporting you? And so what we ended up doing, we sent out applications to say, be part of our pilot program for City Year, frankly, even before we had all the money. So what we ended up doing is we got these wonderful applications, and we asked questions on what are the three biggest problems facing society? Why do you want to serve? We were offering at the time $60 a week. So what we ended up doing is we photocopied the applications. We brought them into meetings. And after we talked about what we were doing, we said, well, you just spend a couple minutes reading these. Mm-hmm. And literally, the idealism of the young people would jump off the page. And I'm convinced that's why we got our first resources. The very first company to do that was then called Bank of Boston. Now it's Bank of America. Bain & Company, the consulting firm, mm-hmm. was also there on day one. We have Comcast, CSX, the freight train company, Microsoft, Cisco.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Michael Brown, co-founder of City Year, an organization focused on improving the graduation rate in struggling public schools. City Year provides targeted intervention by focusing on improving attendance, tutoring, mentoring, and running after school programs. I want to talk about your personal history. You have had a commitment to service seemingly since very early on. Even in college, you took a year off and worked for Representative Leon Panetta, the Democrat from California. How did that happen?
Well, the very first day I got to college, I went to Harvard University, and the president of the university was then Derek Bok. He welcomed all the freshmen together in the same room, and he said, I want to welcome you to Harvard and ask you to please go away. That was his opening line. And what he meant by that was, you don't have to just go through 4 years. You can go and do something different, come back with a different perspective, perhaps with a passion. And I did that. I spent a year working on Capitol Hill after my sophomore year for then Representative Leon Panetta. And Leon had legislation about an idea I had never heard of called voluntary national service. So he introduced me to this concept. And his legislation would have created a commission to go around the country and study the idea and come back to Congress with legislation for perhaps a big program one day.
What did your parents do?
My father was a real estate attorney in Boston for 50 years. My mom was at home raising us.
You're one of five?
I'm one of five. I often say that I got my values from my parents. It was a Jewish home. My father used to love Bible stories, and you know, we used to talk about things. I mean, one of the times I remember, he said, "It says in the Talmud that if you're walking through the desert and there's two people and there's only enough water for one, and that one person has it, is there an obligation to share it?" Mm. And I'm like, "Dad, I'm only 5 years old." Mm. But we used to have conversations like that. I realized, and it matters what you talk to your children about. And my mom kept a home of Jewish ritual. And so somewhere between the rituals and these other kinds of things, I think that had a big impact on me. At the same time, mm-hmm. I grew up at a time when we were racing for the moon. There was always something happening, something big. And then when you add the 1960s to it and all of the idealism of the 60s, I think when you combine all that, by the time I had heard about this idea of national service, it sort of was the institutionalization of the idealism that I felt inside of me, that I felt could be brought out of every young person if we simply called on them institutionally to give a year of service.
Your co-founder, Alan Casey, whom you went to college with and you were roommates with, starting freshman year, what was his inclination towards service? He worked for Gary Hart during the presidential campaign in 1984.
So Alan Casey and I were literally assigned to be roommates together first day of freshman year at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And Cydia, really, we can thank the Harvard Freshman Dean's Office, which was responsible for putting roommates together. Mm-hmm. And anyone that knew Alan in high school before I even met him, and anyone that's met him since, knows that he's an extraordinarily idealistic person. And so I was immediately attracted to that idealism. And we started conversations freshman year, like a lot of people have in their dorm room. And as we began to talk about it, we talked about this idea of national service.
You had a meeting with President Clinton, who at the time was a candidate for president in 1992. And you gave him the seed of the idea for AmeriCorps. Can you describe that encounter? How did it happen?
So it was it was December of 1991, during the presidential selection process of 92. It was just a couple months before the New Hampshire primary. So Governor Bill Clinton and other Democratic candidates were hanging around New Hampshire and Massachusetts. And we got a call and said, "He's been asked about national service. You have this program. Can he come and visit you?" So he came and he spent the better part of a couple hours. At the end of that conversation, one of the young people in our program literally took the sweatshirt off his back that said Cydia on it and gave it to him and said, "Governor, please don't forget us." And that was in December of 1991. Now, fast forward to November of 1992, 11 months later, we certainly hadn't seen Bill Clinton. But in the meantime, he'd been elected president of the United States, and he was now president-elect. And it was the day after Thanksgiving, so he's 3 weeks into being president-elect. CNN is covering his every move. He's out there jogging, and guess what? He's jogging in the Cydia sweatshirt that Stephen, our core member, had given to him 11 months before. Well, I'm at home, and I'm reaching for the phone to call Alan Casey, my partner in all this. The phone's ringing. Well, I'm reaching for it, and I know it's Alan. I say, "You watching this?" Mm-hmm. He said, "Yeah, yeah." We all said, "This changes everything," because President Clinton stopped, and he was asked, "President-elect Clinton, what will be your priorities as president?" And he said, "The national debt, healthcare, the economy," still sound familiar. And he said, "And national service will be my fourth priority." And he's wearing the Cydia sweatshirt. Mm. And we realized that he was very serious about starting this. And we worked with his administration on this AmeriCorps concept. And we realized that the power of the presidency to put these ideas forward is incredible. Today, AmeriCorps is the federal investment in national service. It funds many programs. And we're one of those programs that is sponsored by it. We're very grateful to Bill Clinton for getting it started and for supporting us all these years.
In 2003, you helped to form the Save AmeriCorps Coalition, where you spent more than 100 hours testifying in front of Congress because they were about to cut funding of AmeriCorps in half. Can you talk about that experience?
Sure. So it was almost a perfect storm of things. One thing that had happened after September 11th is so many people wanted to do AmeriCorps that there were so many grants out there and people serving that they had to actually pull the grants back from the next year. So we don't have enough. So what we did is we got together with other organizations that had utilized AmeriCorps funds, and we all came together and we formed the Save AmeriCorps Coalition. And within about 100 days, we had 44 governors that had signed a letter for emergency funding, 83 senators, and we held essentially a round-the-clock citizens' hearing on Capitol Hill. They gave us rooms, and we had people come in from all the country, and it was literally for 100 hours. It was four straight days, including at 2 and 3 in the morning, young people who had served, organizations that had benefited, parents of these young people, they testified. I think it made a huge difference. We got a lot of the funding back that year, and the next year, we got the highest funding ever.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Michael Brown, co-founder of City Year, an organization focused on improving the graduation rate in struggling public schools. You have affiliates in Johannesburg and London. How did that come to be?
So the one in Johannesburg, we had an opportunity to meet with President Clinton right after he left office. And we said to him that we wanted to start an international fellowship in his name called the Clinton Democracy Fellowship to invite people from all over the world to see what U.S. programs were doing and to learn from what service programs are happening around the world. It would go in both directions. And we were going to go try to raise money for it and get it started. And he said, great, let's go do that together. And then 2 months later, we got a phone call. He had called the chair of our board, Eli Siegel at the time, who had worked with him to build AmeriCorps. And he said, I just got a call from Nelson Mandela. He wants me to speak in South Africa about how to build civil society. And he said, I want to bring those Citier folks and show them about Citier and AmeriCorps, about how they could engage young people in service. So all of a sudden, from that one meeting, within 2 months, we were on an airplane with Bill Clinton, and we went to South Africa for an extraordinary experience with him and Nelson Mandela. And we were there to share our experience and to learn from theirs. But from that, people in South Africa said, would you start a Citier program? And if you could have told me back when we were all struggling with apartheid, back when I was in college and all, it was our number one issue, that we'd be able to work in a free just South Africa with Nelson Mandela having gone from prisoner to president. Of course we were going to say yes to all of that, even though it was 10,000 miles away. If you don't talk to them by 10 in the morning, it's too late. But it was a labor of love to build City or South Africa.
Going back to the beginning, I've read somewhere when you were starting City Year, you said it was a little bit like running off to join the circus. Why did you say that?
Well, here I had gone to these amazing institutions, and I love the law, and I easily could have gone down that path. I was on the law review. I really thought I could see that path, but I had this sort of other pull. And yet everybody would understand, it's easy to sort of explain to your grandmother that you'd go from Harvard Law School into a top firm, and I had these wonderful offers as well. So the idea of saying no to all that, and I'm going to go just no job, no money, and just simply bang away at this new Macintosh computer and try to fund this national service program, no one really talked then about social entrepreneurship. So it was a little bit of explaining to people that there was even a career path in going off and doing something like that.
But luckily you had a safety net under the tightrope walking life that you were about to pursue, because you could always go back to clerk for Judge Breyer.
So. No, exactly. It was just that I was doing something that just seemed so different from all of that experience.
What do you remember most distinctly about working with Justice Stephen Breyer?
I had an extraordinary experience working with Justice Breyer. He's brilliant. You know, most judges I found at the time, you know, their clerks would sort of help to write the opinions. And, you know, we would do that. We would give him our drafts of things, and then he would say, thank you very much. And he would take the citations, but he would rewrite everything because he could cut through anything. And he would love to come back and talk to us as clerks about these ideas of the law. When I said I wanted to start Citier, he was incredibly supportive. And he's come out to do everything I've ever asked of him. And my favorite one was when he came and he swore in our corps, because we have a pledge that we take. And he said beautifully, he said, my job is to write about the Constitution. He said to these young people, but you're living it and making it come alive. Mm-hmm. And it speaks volumes about what kind of person he is.
You live in Boston, and your wife is a pediatrician. She treats HIV patients.
That's right.
And you have three children. Do you teach them the Talmud, and do you raise them in a Jewish home?
So we're a mixed religious family, and we raise them both with Jewish and Catholic values. As you mentioned, my wife is a pediatrician, and she's my hero. She treats children with AIDS. She's kept children alive into their adulthood.
What's her name?
Charlotte, Dr. Charlotte Mao.
How did you meet Charlotte?
We met at college. We were both at Courier House at Harvard College, and we spent a summer tutoring for the Harvard Summer School and fell in love.
Were you married when you started City Year?
I got married in 1991, so 3 years into City Year. And she's my rock. And at home, we have a saying, mom's always right. And she is. She has the most extraordinary judgment and character. And in that sense, she's been an incredible backbone for City Year.
Do you ever have anything negative to say?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose I can get frustrated like anybody else. But I do, I'm surrounded every day in what I would call a culture of idealism, which is not naivete. And at City Year, we talk about snuffing out cynicism because it's just the enemy of positive good. So I take idealism seriously and as an art and a practice.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica. It's my pleasure.
My guest has been Michael Brown, co-founder of City Year. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.